as I was privileged to overhear discussions of my sexual orientation and probable childhood traumas from 10 to 10:30 each morning through the paper-thin walls of the break room, located adjacent to my office. By these means, I learned that although I was in desperate need of a girdle, I was better off than one of the other female professors, who would never lose all that baby weight by working all of the time. As hard as I worked, I just couldn't get ahead. Showers became a bi-weekly ritual. My breakfast and lunch were reduced to a couple of cans of Ensure from the cases that I kept under my desk. And in desperation, I once threw one of Reba's milk bones in my purse so that I could gum it during a seminar, trying to keep people's attention off of what I knew would be my growling stomach. The acne that I had never wrestled with as a teenager decided to make up for lost time with a magnificent debut, and I passed the workday biting my nails with ferocity. My brief forays into romance had convinced me that I would be relegated to love's bargain bin. None of the single guys that I met could understand why I worked all of the time, and nobody wanted to listen to me talk about plants for hours anyway. Everything about my life looked pretty well messed up compared with how adulthood had always been advertised to me. I was living on the outskirts of town, just where Atlanta ends and southern Georgia begins. I rented a trailer that presided over 3 less than pristine acres of Coweta County and paid extra for the additional privilege of caring for a geriatric mare named Jackie. I figured that this was worth the 35-minute commute. I had always longed for a horse, and the fact that I was officially done with school and employed made it seem possible. Jackie was lovely and a consistently soul-nourishing source of equine comfort to me and made fast friends with Reba. My only complaint was that both my neighbor to the west and my landlord had progressed from being friendly to being creepy as soon as I got my bags unpacked. It puzzled me that the makeshift garage of the trailer contained stacks and boxes overflowing with homemade VHS tapes. My landlord had given me some lame excuse as to why all these tapes couldn't be kept at his house, and I had shrugged and shut the door, not needing the space anyway. The more I thought about it, however, the more difficult it became to conjure up an innocent reason for him to have so freakishly much video stored well away from his wife and children. He was also always showing up unannounced and regaling me with how fascinated he had become that such a little slip of a thing like me was willing to live alone way out in the woods with no gun at her disposal. In a similar vein, my neighbor to the west took to passing by of an evening in order to assure me that, although he may not have looked like he was up to it, his EMT training conferred upon him the necessary skills and experience with which to cut off my clothes in less than 45 seconds, should he deem it necessary. I eventually learned that in Georgia, when someone walks up to you wearing overalls with no shirt underneath them, it is unlikely that something good is about to happen. After 1 year, the check engine light lit up on the first car that I had ever owned. Because I had no idea what it meant, I took it as a sign and traded the damn thing in for a used Jeep, loaded up my dog, and moved into town. I secured lodgings, a long, narrow basement apartment that Bill promptly christened the Rat Hole, within Atlanta's Home Park neighborhood. The Rat Hole butted up against the stockyard of a working steel factory, and I learned many interesting things, including the fact that the fabrication of steel involves dropping whole reams of metal sheets from 12 feet at regular intervals through the night. I spent countless humid Georgia evenings sitting on the back steps at the entrance of the Rat Hole, watching Bill's cigarette tip glow among all the other blinking fireflies, and trying desperately to formulate some kind of plan B against the background music of industrial drums marching me inexorably toward menopause. Bill's lot was considerably weirder than mine, though he endured his with rather more nonchalance and much more resilience than I did. He had landed in Atlanta, happy to find that the monthly rent for a filthy fire trap in Georgia equaled 1/10 the monthly rent for a filthy fire trap in California. But after going 10 rounds with Confederate bedbugs, he was eager to declare surrender, if not outright defeat. He bought a Volkswagen Vanagon, goose-shit yellow, and I helped him move into it, culminating in the strange experience where one loads up one's belongings and drives off to, well, nowhere, seeing as one is already precisely at home. Before we had gone a block toward nowhere, we heard a hard thump followed by the yowl of a cat, and we knew that we were passing the felisphere, a fully functioning feline ecosystem that we had named after Columbia University's Biosphere Project in Arizona. It was an old house inhabited by hundreds of apparently self-sufficient cats that patrolled the neighborhood, their activities disrupted only superficially by human traffic. I forced Reba to duck down in the back seat, knowing that canine hubris is never more tragic than in the face of superior numbers. "Those cats never liked me," Bill reflected. "They never wanted me to move in." He stuck his head out the window. "So long, you furry assholes," he shouted. "You won't have my shoes to piss in anymore." Bill was hard to find when he was living in the van. Cell phones weren't common then, and by definition, he didn't have a fixed address. If he wasn't in the lab, I simply had to go cruising around for him. I checked the usual hangouts, knowing that if I did see the van, he was unlikely to be very far away. "Welcome. Can I offer you a hot beverage?" Bill greeted me from a posture of repose when I walked into the coffee shop that he considered his living room. The place was located next door to a laundromat, my basement, and he could reliably be found there on Sundays. On that particular morning, he was sitting comfortably in a plush armchair, reading the New York Times in front of a gas-powered fireplace, with a double latte in his hand. "You cut your hair again. I hate it," I observed. "It'll grow back," Bill assured me as he rubbed his head. "It was just one of those Saturday nights, you know." There were certain things in life that Bill would go to almost any length to avoid, and one was going to a barbershop. The very idea of the physical intimacy inherent to the haircutting process overwhelmed him, and from the time that I had met him in California, he had sported long, glossy black hair that was not unreminiscent of Cher's. He was commonly mistaken for a woman from the back, and endured constant suggestive sidelong glances from passing men, which then morphed into embarrassed and resentful surprise once they got full sight of his scruffy beard and masculine jaw. This did nothing to decrease Bill's social paranoia, and not long after moving into the van, Bill bought a cordless electric razor, the kind you find at a real haircutter's. He called me at 3 a.m. one night, about a month later, and excitedly relayed that he had shaved his head. "It's very liberating. I feel great. Long hair is so fucking foolish. I feel sorry for guys who have it," he said, expressing the total conviction one finds in those who have only recently been converted. "I can't talk right now," I stammered and hung up nervously. I didn't like the idea of Bill changing drastically, and this was too much for me to absorb. Would Bill, without all that hair, still be Bill? I knew it was irrational, but I felt the need to avoid him for several days. I would see him soon and take it all in, just not right away. I kept telling myself that the shock would be too much, and so I kept making excuses and lying low. Bill noticed this, of course, and it confused him. Eventually, he called me from a payphone in the middle of the night. As soon as I picked up, he said, "I still have the hair, you know. Would it make you feel better to see it?" I thought about it and decided that it probably would. "It's worth a try," I agreed. "Come pick me up." Bill Bill arrived in the van, and I got in, avoiding eye contact. "It's at the reservoir," he explained as we turned north onto Howell Mill Road. Finding a place to park the van for the night was an aggravating problem that Bill had to solve on a daily basis. This was greatly complicated by the fact that the van only barely ran, and so parking and breaking down were pretty much the same thing. Several factors contributed to the complexity of the problem. The van didn't have reverse, so any parking space had to be pulled through. If someone blocked you from the front, you were pretty much stuck there for as long as they stayed. And you had to guess where other people were going to park. The van also lacked first gear, so a slight incline was needful, as a rolling start was imperative to getting the van going in the morning. Worst of all, the starter didn't function once the engine was warm, so wherever you turned off the van, you had to stay for at least 3 hours until the whole thing cooled down enough to start up again. Fueling the van was a dicey arrangement, since the engine couldn't be turned off while filling. Pumping gas is not normally much of a high adrenaline activity, but watching Bill slop the nozzle over the van's sparking muffler with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth could really get your pulse racing. It was about 4 a.m. when we arrived at the reservoir's overlook, which wasn't much to look at, over or otherwise, truth be told. Bill drove onto a small hill and stopped the van, though not the engine, at a slight incline pointing down. "This okay?" he asked, his hands on the keys. He was asking me in code if I thought this was a good place to hang out for 3 hours before he shut down the engine. We went to the reservoir to live deliberately. I signaled my assent by misquoting Thoreau. Bill usually referred to the reservoir as his weekend getaway, since it was technically water surrounded by trees, and was ill-policed during the weekends. In the harsh light of day, it was an ugly square reservoir surrounded by a 12-foot fence rusted through in places, plus a few odd scraggly trees that had been overgrown by kudzu. Bill turned off the van, took his keys out, and pointed with them straight ahead. "The hare's in there," he told me. "Where?" I asked, not sure toward what he was pointing. "In there," he repeated, pointing specifically toward the big sweet gum tree situated about 10 feet in front of the van. I got out and walked over to it. I realized he was probably talking about one of the hollowed-out chambers in its trunk. "Just reach in, it's right there," he encouraged me. I stood and considered it for a while. "No," I declined. "I don't think I will." "What is your problem, anyway?" Bill said in exasperation. "You're acting like a guy shaving off his hair and then hoarding it in a dead tree on the wrong side of town isn't a totally normal thing. My God, you are hung up." I know," I confessed. "It's not you, it's me." I was quiet for a while, probing my subconscious. "I guess I just don't like the idea of that big a part of you just getting cut off and thrown away," I explained as well as I could.
"Duh! Duh! Duh!"
Bill exclaimed.
"Neither do I! Of course fucking not!"
His voice was tight. "That's why I am storing it here. I'm not a barbarian, for Christ's sakes." He reached into the hollow and pulled out a huge wad of black hair. He held it up and shook it under the light cast by the buzzing fluorescent bulb that was perched atop a well-graffitied pole. I stared. "It is magnificent," I had to concede enrapturously. I was impressed by both the glossiness and the sheer volume of the snarl. From a distance, it might have looked as if he were waving goodbye to someone with a dead cat. We looked each other in the eye and laughed. From then on, when he shaved the hair from his head, he always stuffed the product into the same tree, and we would visit occasionally, late at night. It was a comforting ritual, although I was sure that one of us would eventually get bitten on the hand by a raccoon while reaching in. On the nights when we visited the hare, we'd often sit at the reservoir and brainstorm about a children's book based on Bill's life, which we both agreed comprised the most gleefully inappropriate material for such a thing. This particular installment would be called The Getting Tree, and it was about an arboreal parent figure that slowly cannibalized its offspring because of its progressive and oblivious greed. In one of the middle chapters, the boy visits the tree soon after entering puberty, hoping to find within its arms a retreat from the vicious world of adolescence. "I see you're getting hair on your chest," says the tree. "Shave it off and give it to me," it demands casually. Toward the end of the story, the boy has turned into a very old man and has gone completely bald with age and worry. "The raccoons are having baby raccoons again. I need more hair," says the tree. The boy shakes his head apologetically. "I am sorry, but I have no more hair to give you, being just a bald old man." "Stick your arm in the hollow, then, and the raccoons will chew it. An old man's arm is good for chewing anyway," suggests the tree. "Yes," agrees the boy. "Let us stand together, then, and I will lean upon you and let them chew a while." As the book closes, its action is resolved into a poignant tableau, a sacrifice. That's pure Caldecott right there, I observed one night after a particularly productive editing session. Less than 6 months after Bill started living in the van, he knocked on my door at 3:30 in the morning. He came in, and I went to get him some of the coffee that I had just started to brew. That summer had not been going well. "It's a hard life living in a van," Bill would say often, with a wistful sigh. The Georgia heat commonly exceeded 90 degrees by 8:30 in the morning, making sleeping inside a car until any normal hour completely impossible. Bill combated the heat with ingenuity. He found a parking spot within campus lot P3, where he could position the van sideways beneath the drape of an overgrown willow tree, and obtain both cover and shade. He blacked out all the windows, including the windshield, with aluminum foil placed with its reflective side facing out. This kept the van bearably cool until the sun had fully risen. I would cross paths with Bill as early as 7:30 a.m. and see him staggering groggily around the lab with a beaker of water in each hand. By his telling, he had been baked out about an hour earlier and was, as usual, exceeding parched. The desiccating nights he experienced were exacerbated by his habit of ceasing fluid intake at about 6 p.m. each evening. He had no options for urination, and he scoffed openly at the idea of using the bushes. "I have my standards," he declared haughtily. On the night that he showed up at my house, his sleep had been dramatically interrupted. We had always marveled that no one seemed to notice or care that Bill's creepy van was perpetually parked in P3. But in the end, it turned out that someone had, and did, namely the campus police. One night, while Bill was sleeping in a pool of his own sweat, he awoke to an energetic pounding on his windshield. Outside, he could hear a squad car siren chirping against staccato CB radio communications. He rolled the van's door open. He didn't look like a particularly model citizen. He had planned to shave his head the day before, but got only halfway done before the batteries in his razor ran out, which gave him a sort of escaped mental patient look. The van stank in the way that such close quarters usually do, and across the passenger seats were sprawled the guts of his portable television. He had taken it apart in order to tinker with the wiring. While a flashlight blinded him, he heard a disembodied voice asking, "Sir, can we see some identification?" After they were satisfied that there was nothing sinister in the van, Bill showed them his driver's license, university ID, passport, and even the Ziploc bag of hair recently harvested from the left side of his head. Soon after that, I received a call from the police asking me to verify that Bill was my employee. We found him sleeping in a van in a campus parking lot, they explained to me over the phone. Yeah, lot P3, I confirmed, under the willow. Once they figured out that Bill represented no threat to anyone, and that he certainly hadn't done anything criminal, the police officers were extremely apologetic for disrupting his evening. They really had no choice but to wake him up. It was their job, and, well, you know how it is. Bill assured them that there were no hard feelings. You know, there's a campus emergency phone right down the hill, one of them reminded him in a fatherly way. You be sure to use it if you ever need anything. After they drove off, Bill dressed and came over to my place, supposing that I might appreciate an explanation for the phone call. I don't know how you can be so calm about this. I was upset. You are exactly the kind of guy that they could pin something on if they wanted to. A weirdo loner who periodically shoves body parts into a tree? Oh, come on, I have nothing to hide. I don't do drugs and I don't make trouble. I positively radiate normalcy, he said, and I had to agree that it was true in its way. Neither of us had ever done any drugs, even during all those years at Berkeley. In fact, we didn't even drink beer on field trips, which was practically unheard of in the earth sciences. I had knowingly made some photocopies under the previous user's departmental code, but I hadn't done anything worse than that so far that semester. Well, you do swear too much, I countered, unwilling to completely concede his point. Bill agreed that this was probably fucking true. And look at you. You look like the second coming of a racer head. You're lucky they didn't haul you in just for that. I was angry and scared. Then I relented. Listen, I know this is all my fault. It's because I don't pay you a living wage, but I can't, at least not yet, but soon, soon, I think, we're going to get a really big grant. I searched for something to say that would make my promise sound less empty. Anyway, this was the last straw, I told him. I'm tired of worrying about you every night. You've got to find somewhere to live. I racked my brain for a solution. I'll give you the money. Bill did find somewhere to live. During the next week, he moved into the lab. He slept in one of our student offices, the one that no one wanted to use or even wanted to enter. It had no windows and no ventilation, and thus had absorbed the body odor of everyone who had ever worked in the building, fermented it within the ceiling tiles, and continuously exuded it as a rare bouquet. He called it the hot box because it was perpetually 5 degrees hotter than the rest of the well-heated and poorly cooled old building. He improvised a bed and dresser behind the cover of an old desk and took to sleeping in a t-shirt and khaki pants, his pajakis, so that he could rise up immediately if a secretary or janitor entered, claiming that he was just resting his eyes midway through a long lab experiment. This was nearly ideal, except for the fact that the hot box was located near the front entrance of the building, and Bill found it especially hard to sleep after 9 a.m. once the hordes entered, swinging the doors open and shut. He replaced and greased the relevant hinges, but it didn't help much. After one particularly late night, he put up signs that read, "Doors broken, please use back entrance." But that lasted only until facilities was called over and couldn't find a problem. He packed the biological sample freezers full of frozen dinners and kept his bulk groceries stored within the secretary's fridge until they complained about the 3 whole watermelons that had proven irresistibly cheap at Kroger. Taken altogether, Bill seemed pretty content except for one thing, a lack of private showering facilities. He rigged up a sort of bidet within the mop sink of the janitor's closet, but he had to leave the door propped open so that he wouldn't get locked in while he was using it. Try as we might, we couldn't come up with a convincing cover story for why he would be in there, soaped up and naked at 3 a.m., and I think this fed his natural tendencies toward paranoia. One morning at about 11 o'clock, the fire alarm went off in the building, and upon leaving my office, I saw Bill shuffling along with the many others involved in the evacuation. Barefoot in his pajakis, with his hair sticking up in all directions, and a toothbrush hanging out of his mouth. Once he got outside, he stumbled over to a windowsill planter of geraniums and spit toothpaste into it. I walked over and greeted him. Dude, yuck. You look like Lyle Lovett out on a day pass from somewhere. Bill began to repeatedly flick his near-empty lighter, trying to get one last flame out of it.
If I had a boat, he mumbled around his cigarette, I'd go out on the ocean.
Because he literally had nowhere else to go, Bill was working in the lab for about 16 hours a day. By virtue of availability, he soon became everyone's counselor and confidant. He would help the students fix their bicycles and change the oil in their old cars, go over their 1040 EZ forms with them, and help them figure out where to show up for jury duty, grumbling about it all the while. When the students told him about their lives in the charming way that only a 19-year-old undergraduate does,
get this, the closet in my dorm room has a built-in ironing board. Can you believe it? I'm going to assistant produce the campus radio station's Sunday morning 3:45 a.m. post-reggae punk music hour. At Thanksgiving, when my dad said he had never heard of Gertrude Stein, I was like, who are these people?
He would listen and never judge. He also never reciprocated with any stories about himself, but the students were too absorbed with being young adults to notice. As a rule, Bill didn't share the students' stories with me, but he did make sure to pass on the best of the best. Karen was an undergraduate lab assistant who wanted research experience on her resume in order to beef up her application to veterinary school. Ultimately, she wanted to work with endangered animals that had been rescued from captivity and help repatriate them to their native surroundings. She left us for the summer in order to accept a coveted internship at the Miami Zoo, only to find that most of what zookeepers actually do amounts to pretty routine hygiene maintenance, and that the only thing worse than an animal that doesn't appreciate this is one who does. Placed upon the lowest rung of the ladder, she was sent to work in the primate enclosure. Karen's job was to apply anti-inflammatory cream to monkey genitalia, which were in need of daily soothing due to their constant and indiscriminate use. Once the monkeys had recognized her as their new vehicle of relief, they began mobbing her when she entered the room. Bill and I could hardly absorb this story when she told it to us. It was just too wonderful. But it got even better. It turns out that it is a hard-hearted monkey indeed that remains unmoved during a good slathering of bacitracin. And most monkeys proved considerably more responsive to her reluctant manipulations. The zoo had fitted Karen with a protective plastic shell meant to discourage her charges from clutching onto her and wildly humping her frame, but it wasn't 100% effective. On the upside, her many animal behavior classes had provided her with the intuition necessary to condition these monkeys to the concept of a glory hole. The downside was that seeing them lined up and standing at attention through a chain-link fence first thing in the morning was enough to make her rethink her career in veterinary medicine altogether. She returned to our lab after the internship, having decided that maybe botany wasn't so boring after all. Even though we were always on campus, we didn't know everyone. There was a strikingly pale fellow who used to attend the weekly seminar regularly, always sitting alone, far back in the last row to one side. His countenance was waxy white, and his hair was long and white, too, though he didn't look to be more than middle-aged. He would slip into the lecture hall at the last moment, and be the first to slip out at the end, skipping any and all refreshments and conversation. We never saw him otherwise, and we never heard him speak a word, nor saw him interact with anyone. We decided that he lived in the attic of the building and started calling him Boo Radley. I tried to follow him one day, dodging out early during the questions session, so as to be ready. But he somehow lost me during the confusion of the mass exodus. I used to speculate endlessly about Boo, his probable reactions to each seminar, his expertise, his personal fortune. And then contrive tactics by which we could expose him, violate his privacy, and discover everything that I wanted to know. Bill never showed any interest in my schemes. One night he sat calmly on the building's front steps as I pressed him on the subject, pointing excitedly to the one light that still glowed out of a third-floor office. Bill looked up at the light and then out to the stars. He took a deep drag on his cigarette, exhaled, and said, "I don't know, Scout. He is who he is. I think I'd rather not know more than that. It's enough to know that he's up there, and that he'll step in and save us if anything really bad ever happens." Bill crushed his cigarette on the pavement, looked at me, and took off his fleece jacket. He handed it to me so I could put it on before I even realized that I was cold. Chapter 8. A cactus doesn't live in the desert because it likes the desert. It lives there because the desert hasn't killed it yet. Any plant that you find growing in the desert will grow a lot better if you take it out of the desert. The desert is like a lot of lousy neighborhoods. Nobody living there can afford to move. Too little water, too much light, temperature too high. The desert has all of these inconveniences ratcheted up to their extremes. Biologists don't much study the desert, since plants represent three things to human society: food, medicine, and wood. You'll never get any of those things from the desert. Thus, a desert botanist is a rare scientist indeed, and eventually becomes inured to the misery of her subjects. Personally, I don't have the stomach to deal with such suffering day in and day out. In the desert, life-threatening stresses aren't a crisis. They are a normal feature of the life cycle. Extreme stress is part of the very landscape, not something a plant can avoid or ameliorate. Survival depends on the cactus's ability to tolerate deathly grim, dry spells over and over again. If you meet a barrel cactus that's tall enough to touch your knee, it is likely to be more than 25 years old. Cactuses grow slowly in the desert, during the years when they do grow, that is. A barrel cactus has folds like an accordion, and deep within these folds are the pores that let air in and water evaporate out. When it becomes very dry, a cactus sheds its roots to prevent the parched soil from sucking all the water back out of it. A cactus can live for 4 days with no roots and still continue to grow. If there is still no rain, the cactus begins to contract, sometimes for months, or until all the folds have closed together. Its spines form a dense and dangerous fur, protecting what is now a hard, rootless ball of plant. In this posture, the cactus can sit without growing and await rain for years, while continuously punished by the sun. When it finally rains, the cactus will either return to full functioning within 24 hours or show itself to be dead. There are 100 species or so known as resurrection plants. These species are unrelated, but within each of them, the same process has somehow developed. Resurrection plants have leaves that can be desiccated to papery brown shreds, feign death for years, and then rehydrate back to normal function. It is their unusual biochemistry that allows them to do this. An accidental trait and something that they did not choose. As they wither, their leaves fill with concentrated sucrose, thick sugar left behind during the drying. This syrup stabilizes and preserves the leaves, even when they are drained of their green chlorophyll. Resurrection plants are usually tiny, no bigger than your fist. They are ugly and small and useless and special. When it rains, their leaves puff up but do not become green for 48 hours, because it takes time for photosynthesis to start up. During those strange days of its reawakening, the plant lives off of pure concentrated sugar, an intense, sustained infusion of sweetness, a year's worth of sucrose coursing through its veins in just one day. This little plant has done the impossible. It has transcended the wilted brown of death. The miracle is not sustainable, of course, and within a day or two things will inevitably go back to normal. Such a crazy life takes its toll, and in the long term, even a resurrection plant withers and dies completely. But for a brief, glorious moment, it knows something that no other plant has ever known. How to grow without being green. Chapter 9. Full-blown mania lets you see the other side of death. Its onset is profoundly visceral and unexpected, no matter how many times you've been through it. It is your body that first senses the urgency of a new world about to bloom. Your vertebrae seem to detach from one another, and you elongate as if toward the sun's light. You can't hear above the sloshing roar of blood pushed through your head by some impossibly sustained orgasm within your beating heart. For the next 24, 48, 72 hours, you will have to yell to hear yourself over this whooshing. Nothing, nothing can be loud enough, or bright enough, or move fast enough. The world appears as if through a fisheye lens. Your view is fuzzy with sparkling edges. You have received a grand systemic injection of Novocaine, and your entire body tingles briefly before it becomes flaccidly foreign and unreal. Your raised arms are the fleshy petals of a magnificent lily bursting into flower. It deeply dawns on you that this new world about to bloom is you. Deep night is no longer dark, and why did you ever think it was dark at night? The darkness of night is like all of the other impossibly simple things that you used to believe, but against which there is coming a revelation of multidimensional glory. Soon you don't register day versus night because you don't need sleep. You don't need food or water or a hat against the frigid weather for that matter either. You need to run. You need to feel the air on your skin. You need to take off your shirt and run so you can feel the air, and you explain this to the person holding you, that it's okay, it's okay, it's okay to do this, but he doesn't get it and his face looks worried like someone died, and you feel pity for him because he doesn't realize how wonderful and okay and okay and okay everything is. So you explain how it is and he doesn't get it. And you tell more and more in a different way, and he isn't really listening, and he says, don't you have anything for this, and why don't you take some of it, and you explain that you don't want that stuff, and you need to feel this, and he doesn't get it, and he doesn't get it, and so you viciously order him to go, go, go away. And he finally does. But it's okay, because you didn't mean it, and he'll explain it all later, and he'll see, because it will all make sense, and he'll be glad too once he understands that something wonderful is about to happen, and it would be a sin to keep it from coming. Then comes the best part. It is the final lifting. Not only has the weight of your body dissolved, but all the collective trouble of this ancient, weary world as well. The hunger, the cold, the misery, the hopelessness of every human hurt the world over seems manageable and solvable. There is nothing, nothing, nothing that will not be transcended. And you are the exalted, the one person out of billions, utterly free from the burden of this existential pain that all must carry. The future will be splendid and full of miracles, and you can taste its coming. You don't fear life, and you don't fear death. You don't fear anything. There is no sadness, and there is no grief. You feel your subconscious formulating the answers to all the collective miserable searching that man has ever done. You have indisputable proof of God and the creation of the universe. You are the one for whom the world has waited, and you will give it all back. You will pour out all you know and then wallow knee-deep in all the viscous love, love, love. When I die, I will identify heaven only secondarily by these feelings, and primarily by their failure to end. While I am constrained to this life, they will always end. And what comes after, like any resurrection, is not without cost. While this great cosmic fire hose bathes you in epiphanies, you are overtaken by your urgent need to document them and thus generate an inspired manual for all perfect tomorrows. Unfortunately, this is also when reality closes ranks and conspires to thwart you in earnest. Your hands shake such that you can't hold a pen. You pull out a tape recorder and push record, and fill cassette after cassette. You talk until you are hoarsely coughing blood. You pace like an animal confined until you faint. Then you get up, change the cassette, and continue on because you are so close to something. Some proof or some desperate hope that your own little life was actually meant for something less confusing and more worthwhile. And then it's too loud, and it's too bright, and there's too much too close to your head, and you scream, scream, scream it away. And then someone is holding you saying, oh God, how did this happen? And what is this, your hair? And sweet Jesus, one of your teeth on the floor. And they dab at the blood and the snot. And they feed you a single sleeping pill. And you sleep and wake to one more sleeping pill. And you sleep and wake to one more sleeping pill. As if they were feeding with an eyedropper a broken baby robin that had fallen out of its nest. Hours, or is it days later, you wake to a gray sadness that mutes you into a silent weeping numbness, and you wonder why you are being punished like this. Finally, fear overcomes sadness, and you roll back the stone, crawl out of the tomb to assess the damage, and then do what needs to be done. Fear overcomes shame, and you make a doctor's appointment to beg and wheedle for more sleeping pills as your only stockpile against next time, next time, next time. And by luck, by stupid luck, or time, or chance, or providence, or Jesus, who cares? Your appointment happens to be at the best hospital in the world, and a doctor looks at you hard, and he says, you don't have to live this way. And he asks questions until you've told him everything, and he's not horrified or disgusted or even surprised. He says people have this, and they manage it. He asks you how you feel about medicine, and you tell him that you aren't afraid of anything made in a laboratory. He smiles and describes the drugs one by one. And you want to get on the floor and kiss his hand like a dog because you are so grateful. This doctor is so smart and so sure and has seen this so many times that you begin to dare to hope that maybe it's not too late to finally grow into what you were supposed to be. Years later, while preparing to move across the world, you find the stack of cassette tapes at the bottom of your closet. You realize that you won't be bringing them along. One by one, you disembowel the tapes, pulling out reels of shiny brown floss. A curly mess is all that remains from the sprawling ecstasy of those anguished high holidays. You sit for an hour and vow to try to love what's left of the poor sick girl who recorded her own cries night after night with only a machine to hear her. You decide that this plastic snarl, though dead, is still precious. That it is the placenta that was attached to you while you writhed in the dark, waiting to be born. You stand up, carry it outside, and bury it under the magnolia tree. You come inside and pack all of the things that you will take with you, and try to forgive yourself for what you're leaving behind. But that particular day of health and healing is still many years distant within my story. So let's go back to 1998 in Atlanta, and I'll keep describing how the world spins when mania is as strong and ever-present as gravity. Chapter 10. Where the hell have you been? Bill hollered at me when he came around the corner and saw me standing in the lab. I blinked at him numbly. I've been in a funk, I tried to say offhandedly, even as I choked on my shame. I had been lying in bed crying for 36 hours after crashing down from my latest throbbing mania. This one triggered by the corticosteroid injections necessary to quell an acute allergic reaction. We had been studying plants along the Mississippi River, traveling through Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana while trying to sample our way through an unbelievably lush gauntlet of poison ivy. Plants sweat while they photosynthesize, and our textbooks teach that, like us, the hotter it gets, the more they sweat. Along the Mississippi River, there are thousands of trees of the same species growing along a tidy temperature gradient. The farther south you travel, the hotter it gets. We'd developed a method to measure sweating rates by comparing the chemistry of the water in the stem with that of the water inside the leaf, which is where the sweating, or evapotranspiration, takes place. We were startled to find that as spring progressed into summer, sweating rates went down and not up, even though the weather was getting hotter and hotter at all of the sites. It didn't make any sense to me, and the more I sweated over the problem, the more the trees did not. We had done the field trip 3 times already, and my allergic reaction to the rampant poison ivy had gotten worse each time. Nonetheless, we kept anxiously wading through the waist-high fields of ivy in order to find the stubborn trees that we'd first fixed upon for sampling. I wouldn't and couldn't let the study go. And the horrible itching that I felt was nothing compared with the discomfort that I felt when each data set looked completely different from the way we thought it should. During our most recent trip, a rash had raged up my neck and onto my face, giving rise to a massive edema at my right temple that not only made me look like the Elephant Man, but also pressed against my right ocular nerve until I lost partial vision in that eye. I knew it was really bad when Bill stopped taunting me with the nickname Meathead while we drove tensely back to Atlanta from Poverty Point, Louisiana, a real place, stopping only to drop me off at the Emory Hospital emergency room. After obtaining my written consent for photographs, because we could probably publish this, the doctors injected me with methylprednisolone and then brought in the cameras. They positioned me on tissue paper and clicked away while I tried not to giggle at the absurdity of the idea that our hopeless plant study might result in a publication after all. After a few more hours of waiting around, I realized that I didn't have the cab fare to get home and started to wish that I had asked Bill for some cash when he had dropped me off.
The rat hole was somewhere west of where I was. I reckoned it at about 5 miles away. I lay in my hospital bed, nestled in paper, until I began to understand that I was absolutely gorgeous and fantastic. I went to the bathroom, looked at myself in the mirror, and decided that I might as well get out of there, because I'd hardly be the strangest character on Ponce de Leon Avenue, especially at that time of night. By the time I got to the nurse's station, I was also pretty sure that I was the next Jesus. They discharged me anyway, and I walked, skipped, and then ran through the Druid Hills with ideas coming to me so fast that I couldn't finish one thought before another one started up. I had to get back to the lab because I had actually remembered something important. During my agricultural science courses, I'd been taught about the delicate art of irrigation and the physics of water flow through porous soils. I remembered that for every 1 gram of tissue that a corn plant builds, it requires almost 1 liter of water. It sweats the water out to cool the biochemical machinery that turns atmosphere into sugar and sugar into leaf. As the growing season progressed along the Mississippi, the deciduous trees must have stopped growing, having built all their new leaves back in the spring. The trees were sweating less, I realized, because the growing season was over and the system had achieved equilibrium. Yes, as summer advanced, it was getting hotter and hotter all over the South, but the trees were already getting ready for winter. Their growth rate was slowing, so they were sweating less, too. These trees' activities weren't passively dictated by the temperature of our world. They were part and parcel of the goals of their world, which was focused upon making leaves. I started thinking about the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco. Thousands of important scientists all in one place. I had to get there and spread the good gospel of my revelation. I arrived breathlessly at the lab and eagerly revealed to Bill my crowning inspiration. We were going to go to the conference without any travel funds, personal or professional. I had figured it out. We'd drive. Sure, the meeting was in California and we lived in Georgia, but it was 8 whole days away, which allowed plenty of time for us to get there. My reasoning went like this. 3,000-odd miles at 60 miles per hour came out to just 50 hours of driving, and we could break it into 10 behind-the-wheel shifts lasting 5 hours each. That's 5 days of driving, with only 1 shift of driving on each day if we took 2 students with us. 5 easy days of driving. We'd fill out the paperwork to rent one of the university vans that came with its own gas card, and camp all along the way. Technically illegal, but still. It would then take months for the accounts to come due, and by that time I'd have the funding somehow, because one of my many proposals just had to result in a contract eventually. And after all, you can't get funding if no one knows who you are, and so you have to appear at every conference and show them who you are, right? I had previously submitted a vague abstract describing the Mississippi Project to the meeting. Within it, I had hypothesized that the plants in my study used water more to support rapid growth than for cooling. It was an early attempt to shift focus away from the idea that the environment controls the plant and into a scenario where the plant controls the environment, a theme that I would reprise many times within many contexts over the coming years. But for that early conference, I didn't have a clear narrative in place. I just hoped against hope that I'd have somehow worked out what to say at the conference by the time that I got there, if I ever got there. I began to rattle on to Bill about how the road trip is the only essentially American literary vehicle, as first pioneered by Huck Finn on the Mississippi. As with many of my manic filibusters, what I lacked in coherence, I more than made up for in enthusiasm. Bill rolled his eyes. "Shut your me-hole and go home and get some sleep," he advised. I scurried home, and before long all hell broke loose as I soared up to a peak of mania and then crashed into an abyss of depression, all within the miserable privacy of my locked apartment. Now I was back. It was days later, and Bill was looking me up and down. He brushed off the awkwardness and urged me to snap out of it because we're hitting the road. He was shaking our ragged Michelin Georgia State Road Atlas in one hand, and the van keys in another. I stood amazed. While I had been mysteriously out of commission, Bill had taken my delirious suggestion as a serious order, reserved the van, and packed our gear. I smiled weakly, grateful for yet another chance to start over and do better. The timing puzzled me, however, as it was already Wednesday, and my talk was scheduled for 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. We were now looking at 3, not 5, very long days of driving in order to get there by Saturday night. We started digging through the cardboard box where we kept our stash of the Free State Highway maps that we had stealthily removed from our local AAA office during multiple nervous visits, staged for that very purpose. Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and God damn it, we don't have Texas. Bill bemoaned the one map out of 50 that we hadn't thought to steal. How in the world did we forget Texas? Okay, so forget Texas. Let's go north, I suggested. Have you ever been to Kansas? Bill shook his head. Well, you're about to go, I assured him as I pulled Kentucky, Missouri, Kansas, and Colorado out of the box. I laid the maps end to end and measured with my hands. If we went up and across on I-70, the halfway point was at about Denver, and I had friends in Greeley who would surely let us stay and sleep off the first all-nighter, making us ready to roll again by noon on Friday. From there it was maybe 15 hours to Reno, where we could camp at relatively low elevation before crossing Donner Pass and coming down into San Francisco by Saturday night, where Bill confirmed that his sister was ready to welcome us into her townhouse for the duration of the meeting. Sure, it was already the first week of December, but I was from Minnesota and everything would be fine. Salt Lake City, you're gonna love it, I assured Bill. It's like an ocean of frozen mercury. It's like nothing else. I went on in raptures about the prairies, plains, and mountains we would cross, until I had fully regained my clear-eyed ambition. There's simply no way that this is not a good idea, I asserted, and we couldn't help but laugh at the sheer ridiculousness of this claim, while simultaneously being thoroughly convinced of its veracity. As we packed up the van, I was further amazed to hear that Bill had indeed invited a bunch of students and had even gotten a couple of takers. My graduate student Terry was certainly coming. She had recently returned to graduate school after working in the real world as a consultant for 10 years, and I felt that it was urgent that she should begin networking as soon as possible. Though we suspected that Terry hadn't been out of Georgia much, we didn't know just how little before that trip. Noah, our genius undergraduate who could do almost anything but never said a word while doing it, had agreed, silently, I presumed, to come. He had no driver's license and so wouldn't be of much help with the driving, but I relished the idea that he'd open up to us over the 50-plus-hour drive and that we'd really get to know him. Bill, who had already spent a lot of time with Noah, was less optimistic about this and had already started referring to him as the warm-blooded cargo. We double-checked the maps and the camping gear, and then drove to Chevron and filled the 16-seater van's obese gas tank. After that, we drove to Kroger, and I stuffed our large cooler with Diet Coke, ice, bread, Velveeta cheese, and bologna, while Bill organized the candy trove. We agreed that the three drivers would rotate through 3-hour shifts behind the wheel, allowing each driver to have 6 hours of rest between shifts.
Thus, we would stop once approximately every 200 minutes to change drivers, buy gas, and take a bathroom break during the swap.